You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And once again, Shane O'Farnan, our stalwart associate producer, law school graduate, and head constitutional Supreme Court, the kings and queens of America, reporter for the Talk Radio News Service. Went into the lion's den today.
Well, if they're the kings and queens, I guess I'm the jester. But
well,
or the reporter upon.
Yeah, or the court reporter. It's, yeah.
So, don't
so, so, yes, today, yesterday was California Prop 8, and I think there's a kind of a broad consensus. You shared it with us first here, and but it seems to have echoed through the media chamber over the last 24 hours that in all probability they're going to say to California, you know, if Jerry Brown doesn't want to defend this thing,
right?
You know, if the governor doesn't want to defend it, then
we're going to let it be.
Yeah.
But it's only going to be for California, California alone, and other states you can do what you'd like to do in the future, and we'll deal with this later.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a very reasonable prediction. But what's really interesting here is there's almost an analogy, is there not, in as much as the Defense of Marriage Act, just like Jerry Brown didn't want to defend Proposition 8 before the Supreme Court, and the Attorney General for the state of California didn't want to defend Prop 8 against before the Supreme Court. President Obama doesn't want to, you know, defend DOMA before the Supreme Court, and neither does Attorney General Eric Holder.
Right.
And so there being nobody to defend it, John Boehner went out and said, da-da-da, me and a bunch of right-wing Republicans in the House of Representatives are going to take some taxpayer dollars and hire some private lawyers, and we're going to create this organization called BLAG. BLAG is going to argue this thing before the Supreme Court, and we're going to argue that we are going to be harmed if gay people can get married. Oh, my God. Right? Do I have that right?
You have that right. And BLAG itself is not – the ability of the House to form these committees is not in a statute anywhere. They put it in their House rules. So,
really?
Yeah. So there's no statutory authority for this. And this was questioned before the court. Sotomayor is like, well, you – under the Constitution, you have rulemaking authority. But that's to run the House. That's inside the House of Representatives. You can't use your rulemaking authority to work on things outside of the House.
Like the Supreme Court.
Right.
Why'd you cross the street, boy?
But they came back and said, well, you know, states have done this. The state legislatures in other cases have done this. And on top of it, there was I didn't know about this until the argument today. House Resolution 5 passed the House, which authorized BLAG by the whole House of Representatives by majority vote to represent them before the Supreme Court in this case.
But did it have funding associated with it?
I haven't read the text of it.
Yeah.
But I have heard stories that it's been reported that it is House money that is going to pay for these attorneys.
Yeah. Please forgive my bad imitation of a Southern sheriff from the 60s, by the way, you know, with that boy in there. It's every now and then those old Mel Gibson or Mel Brooks movies pop into my. Anyway, the bottom line for what happened today, there's a standing issue just like there was yesterday, and then there is
the
merits of the case. So on the standing.
Standing was they actually set aside 50 minutes for standing. And because all the parties, there was no disagreement, but they all agreed there was jurisdiction. So they had to appoint somebody even to come in and argue against jurisdiction, of all things. So none of the parties argues against jurisdiction. The United States government, you know, the president, the attorney general said there is jurisdiction. BLAG said there was jurisdiction. Windsor said there was jurisdiction. The court said, I'm not so sure there's jurisdiction. So they had someone else come in and argue it. And that was 50 minutes. And ahead of time when I was reading about this, a lot of the punditry didn't really think that standing was going to be a big issue. But the Supreme Court obviously thinks it is. Because they brought it up, they wanted to argue far more than yesterday about it.
Well, and also this gives them another escape hatch.
It does. Although I don't think they're going to – it just seems illogical. Not that the Supreme Court's always logical, but they had hundreds of DOMA cases to choose from. Mm-hmm. If they wanted to hear DOMA and they really wanted to rule on DOMA, why would they pick this one instead of the other 99 or more cases?
Maybe because this one had such glaring jurisdictional –
But if they do kick it on the basis of standing, they really haven't decided any merits. All it will do is say DOMA will stay on the books, The Second Circuit's opinion would be that it's unconstitutional, but the other circuits can go their own way.
Right.
So it doesn't solve or answer any questions.
No, but that's my point. Is
they don't want
that
to. You
had, for example, if they're trying to avoid, and I think that John Roberts did this with Obamacare, they're trying to avoid a Roe v. Wade, a Brown v. Board,
right.
A Citizens United, Bush v. Gore.
Wish they had thought of that sooner.
Yeah, right. They're trying to avoid a significant decision, a definitional decision.
Right.
And then they know that if they can just kick this can down the road for a couple of years, DOMA's going to go away. You know, there's no way this thing is going to last, even a decade.
Well, unlike kicking it down the road yesterday, more and more states, yes, will enact same-sex marriage, but DOMA won't go away unless Congress repeals it.
Well, that's my point. Congress is going to have to repeal it. The pressure is going to get so great. I mean, you've got, when you get a half a dozen or a dozen states, just like, we have two states now that have legalized marijuana.
True.
And, you get 8, 10, 12, 14, 16 states that have decriminalized pot.
Right.
The federal government's going to have to reschedule pot. And I think the same thing with gay marriage here. If you get enough states saying we recognize gay marriage, the IRS is going to have to say we got to do something, and the right. Republican Party is going to have to say we got to do something. You got Renz Priebus running around going we're going to rebrand the party. Well, here's where you can start.
Well, maybe this will be a good thing after all. But then what concerns me is we actually do turn into a Roe v. Wade situation in that each state gets to decide. So now they have 50 different battlegrounds on which to fight same-sex marriage with the terrible arguments they put forward and fundraise on it.
But they're starting to lose badly.
I understand, but they might still have those bulwark states like Alabama and Mississippi for decades and decades to come.
Yeah, this is sort of the argument that ultimately led to Loving versus Virginia.
Sure.
But, again, even that would have been – I think eventually even Virginia would have come around, although you – Well, anyway, we're debating this as if we were on the Supreme Court. We're not. On the merits.
On the merits. The Blag came forward defending DOMA, saying the reason for this case, they didn't really get into the social issues.
Right.
It was interesting. Although it was in the papers, it wasn't in the argument today. The Supreme Court wasn't going to say it, wasn't going to consider it even, because the federal government, they outright said, doesn't have any of those interests. That's the state's interest. So the argument was uniformity, that the federal government needs uniformity across the states, no matter what the states do, in terms of enforcing their federal law. And Alito, Justice Alito, made a compelling hypothetical towards this, which will tell the story a little better. What if you have three couples, military couples, same-sex couples, and they are married, one in a state that recognizes marriage, one that recognizes civil unions, and one that doesn't recognize marriage, all right? And one of those military people gets injured. You're going to have three different outcomes two different outcomes. One of them in the same-sex state would be able to visit that person in the hospital. The other two wouldn't. So they would be treated actually unequally because the federal law would look to states' definitions of marriage rather than that
And thus the question, should there be a federal definition of marriage?
Right, but many of them just said no, there should not be. That the federal government is not their job.
Except that for tax purposes, we tax married people differently, so there has to be some sort of federal definition, or at least some federal acknowledgement of the state's definition.
Well, they could do something that doesn't use the word marriage. In fact, Justice Alito suggested this, but not call it marriage. We'll just redefine it altogether.
Yeah.
So we take marriage out of
that.
There's 11,000, I think, was the number mentioned. Different.
If you include all the state laws, it's 1,100 in the federal code. Yeah.
Federal code. Different laws they'd have to change. So it's not like you can just find replace all.
Right.
It would take a lot of work by Congress, and they're not.
And Congress is not inclined to do that any more rapidly than they're going to overturn DOMA.
No, they're not even in town.
So it looks like on the merits, DOMA is toast. Given what we said,
I think
probably 5-6, 5-4.
Maybe,
probably Kennedy joining the liberals.
I think Roberts may.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. Very, very, especially given that Roberts' gay cousin was in the gallery yesterday.
Yes.
I believe today. Shane O'Farnon, we'll be back with more.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Blag. Did you ever hear this? I mean, why is this not the big media story? That we have to have the Blag? Really? Blag? 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Shane O'Farnon, the Supreme Court reporter for the Talk Radio News Service, our associate producer We get to share him with them. And Shano, you were in the Supreme Court this morning, listening to the arguments, watching. First of all, the fact that these guys, men and women, do not allow cameras in the court just proves to me that we really do live in a constitutional monarchy, and that they are the kings and queens, and that they will not allow little people to see them or hear them, well, originally even to hear them.
And now think about how difficult it is to get in. You had people lining up outside over the weekend, and I know I had to reserve a press seat, and it was just a reservation. I wasn't guaranteed a seat a month in advance.
Wow.
So what I will say, though, is if you go over to the supremecourt.gov, go under oral arguments, you will find the audio there, and you will find the printed transcript. So you can listen along, watch the transcript, listen along. You'll know who's saying what.
Right.
You get a really good idea of what was argued there if you're interested. If you're so inclined, I encourage everyone to do that.
So
that is a great window in.
Let's listen to some of the things that you heard today that you thought were noteworthy. You want to share with us what we're hearing?
The first clip is Justice Scalia talking about jurisdiction. Scalia and Roberts were really upset that the president and the attorney general would not defend DOMA.
Right.
Scalia even referred.
Well, may I put a finer point on that?
Sure.
Not just that he wouldn't defend it, but that he was also still enforcing it.
Right.
That basically, weren't they saying, if you don't like this law, then just stop enforcing it, let somebody sue you, and then we'll have an actual case in front of us.
Right. And Justice Scalia referred to when he was at the Office of Legal Counsel, how there was an opinion from that Office of Legal Counsel that the Attorney General shall enforce and defend all laws.
Right.
He should be forced to do this to defend them. But this is Scalia saying, why in the world are we here? Are we just here for fun?
Clearly, that's very peculiar. When both parties to the case agree on what the law is, just for fun, the district judge is going to have a hearing?
And here's Justice Roberts talking, actually calling out the president for enforcing an unconstitutional law, just what you were talking about before this.
I would have thought your answer would be that the executive's obligation to execute the law includes the obligation to execute the law consistent with the Constitution. And if he has made a determination that executing the law by enforcing the terms is unconstitutional, I don't see why he doesn't have the courage of his convictions and execute not only the statute, but do it consistent with his view of the Constitution, rather than saying, oh, we'll wait till the Supreme Court tells us we have no choice.
This was basically Thomas Jefferson's argument when in 1803, when Marbury versus Madison. I mean, he was, you know, each branch of the government should decide for itself what is or isn't constitutional and act on that decision. And if the people disagree with them, they will throw the bums out. And if the people agree with them, they'll reelect them. And so if the president thinks this is an unconstitutional law, he should direct the IRS to recognize, people in states that have acknowledged gay marriage as being legally married and give them deductions and inheritance rights.
Exactly. And I
agree with Jefferson, and weirdly, I agree with Justice Roberts.
And if there is some kind of great injustice in a specific, very narrow case between two people, that's what the courts are for. But they don't. The courts aren't there to say, here's the rule for everyone, just in this one case.
So, in a way, what Justice Roberts was saying was the president's wimping out here.
He was calling him out.
Amazing.
He definitely was, but then he, way later, and I don't know if we'll have time to play this because it's about a two-minute clip, he really got into the politics of it. This was the gay lobby, and they are so powerful now that that's where the sea changes come from.
Robert said that?
Robert, oh, yeah, 2 minutes. I guess there was probably a little bit of extra time with one of the, I don't remember which attorney it was, but he went into a very long discussion of his opinion about where the sea change came from. It was a lot of money being dumped into a lot of same-sex marriage proponent lobbyists.
Well, that's true. I mean, was he complaining about that,
or was he
celebrating it?
He was saying that the society hasn't changed because they're becoming better and more open. The society is changing because they're being told to by a bunch of lobbyists.
Oh, that's weird.
They're not opening people's minds. The minds are being opened for them and becoming, because a lot of money's been paid and a lot of time, because they're very quote unquote powerful.
Right. So Roberts is of the opinion that our opinions are up for sale, that the younger generation's acceptance of gay marriage is not because more and more people are coming out and people are discovering that there are gay people in their family. Oh, my God, never knew it. But
to lace that together with what that clip we just played, if you link those two together, he's saying the president is a victim of that as well.
Right. So Roberts is, you know, sees a gay conspiracy here, apparently.
Apparently.
So Justice Kennedy, what's this clip number two here?
Let's play number three. This is great. This is Justice Ginsburg talking about the ridiculousness of, and what would happen if with the, keeping this uniform, quote unquote, which they uniformity is a good thing, but this would is what would happen if you kept that federal law.
As Justice Kennedy said, 1,100 statutes, and it affects every area of life, and so you would be really diminishing what the state has said is marriage. You're saying no. State, there are two kinds of marriages, the full marriage and then the sort of skim milk marriage.
Right. So this is she's talking about how because the IRS doesn't recognize gay marriages, even though some states do, in those states where you have gay marriage recognized, you have a marriage, but it's a skim milk marriage.
Right. Exactly. And this is really what the two arguments down, Justice Kagan summed them up. What's the purpose behind DOMA? Is it some kind of animus towards same-sex people, same-sex couples, or is it for uniformity?
It was animus, in my opinion.
They actually talked about how they wanted to, what's the term, morally, wow, I wish I have it in my...
Well, DOMA was an attempt to say, you know, that we're gonna get rid of the gays, I mean, or gay marriage, or we're gonna make sure that it can't.
But in the congressional record for DOMA, one of the congresspeople said that DOMA was there to express the moral disapproval of same-sex marriage. So that's what they were.
So thus animus. Animus is the Latin word for hatred.
And animus is not a good enough reason.
Yeah.
So here we go.
Do we really think that Congress was doing this for uniformity reasons, or do we think that Congress's judgment was infected by dislike, by fear, by animus, and so forth?
Yeah, that's the question.
And in fact, the congressional record indicates that it was the latter.
For some of the congresspeople.
At least for some congressmembers, yeah. And yeah, very interesting. Okay, we'll come back. We'll play that longer clip of Justice Roberts. I'm really curious to hear him going off on the political lobbyists. Pick up some phone calls and continue with our conversation about what happened in the Supreme Court today. Stick around, Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And, of course, Shane O'Farnan, our associate producer and Supreme Court reporter for the Talk Radio News Service. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Shane O'Farnon's still here with us. Well, you're here with us every day, all day. Shane, it's great to have you. It's great to have you back on the air with us. You've got a couple more clips you wanted to share with us. You were telling us about how Roberts, during the oral arguments this morning, went off on about a two-minute rant saying that there was this gay lobby that was...
There was some back and forth, but he did most of the talking, for sure. I don't know how much we need to play of it to get the gist of it, but
I'm more than pleased to hear the whole thing.
Here we go.
I suppose the seat change has a lot to do with the political force and effectiveness of people representing, supporting your side of the case?
I disagree with that, Mr. Chief Justice. I think the seat change has to do, just as was discussed in Bowers and Lawrence, with an understanding that there is no difference, there is no fundamental difference that could justify this kind of categorical discrimination between gay couples.
You don't doubt that the lobby supporting the enactment of same-sex marriage laws in different states is politically powerful, do you?
With respect to that category, that federalization of the term for purposes of heightened scrutiny, I would, Your Honor. I don't.
Really?
Yes.
As far as I can tell, political figures are falling over themselves to endorse your side of the case.
The fact of the matter is, Mr. Chief Justice, is that no other group in recent history has been subjected to popular referenda to take away rights that have already been given or exclude those rights the way gay people have. And only two of those referenda have ever lost. One was in Arizona. It then passed a couple of years later. One was in Minnesota, where they already have a statute on the books that prohibits marriages between gay people. So I don't think, and until 1990, gay people were not allowed to enter this country. So I don't think that the political power of gay people today could possibly be seen within that framework, and certainly is analogous. I think gay people are far weaker than women were at the time of Frontier.
Well, but you just referred to a sea change in people's understandings and values from 1996 when DOMA was enacted, and I'm just trying to see where that comes from, if not from the political effectiveness of groups on your side of the case.
To flip the language of the House report, Mr. Chief Justice, I think it comes from a moral understanding today that gay people are no different and that gay married couples' relationships are not significantly different than the relationships of straight married couples. I don't think that...
Well, I understand that. I'm just trying to see how where that moral understanding came from, if not the political effectiveness of a particular group.
I think it came...
What did she say at that point? Where
I don't remember.
Okay, because my take on this is that it is not, you know, the so-called gay lobby. It's not, you know, wealthy gay donors and all that kind of thing. There certainly is, you know, a fair amount of money in the gay community, and they do contribute to political things and whatnot. But I don't think that's I disagree with Justice Roberts. I agree with that woman that was speaking that you know.
That was the attorney for Windsor.
Okay, that was the attorney for Windsor. That
I believe.
That what has happened, the sea change that has happened, it looks to me, now here I am, a straight old white guy, so, you know, looking from the outside, although, you know, I have gay friends and gay family members and, you know, and we certainly have discussed this, you know, for 10 years on this radio program, but it looks to me like what has led the charge here is not that a bunch of gay people bought advertising or bought congressmen, you know, did lobbying, but rather that average gay people, truck drivers and bus drivers and military people and you know, even millionaires and people in the media, Anderson Cooper, that gay people who before 1996 went to great lengths to hide the fact that they were gay, and particularly at the higher levels of income and power, people who knew that they were gay collaborated in keeping it a secret. It was an open secret in this town, and frankly it still is.
Sure.
Who are the members of Congress who are gay, who are not out, and people don't violate that. Okay, so that was always the case, that there and what has been happening since the mid 90s, what's been happening over the last generation, basically the last 20 years, is that through a very, I think probably very wrenching and painful process, at least initially, it's getting probably easier, but it still can't be easy. Mm-hmm. Gay people are coming out.
Yes.
And as they're coming out, their family members, their friends, their colleagues, their coworkers, their viewers on television, whatever it may be, are going, oh, well, he's not so different. Mm-hmm. She's not so odd.
And then that acceptance expands and more people are feel more comfortable coming out. So it grows in that way. It's always been there. It's just the acceptance hasn't been.
It's the Jackie Robinson effect.
But I think what Roberts was trying to say is, remember, Barack Obama famously said he had a change of heart, that he had evolved.
Right.
So he was kind of trying, I think, I can't read his mind, but was saying the reason you evolved is because, as he said, political officials falling all over themselves to join your side because of money and lobbyists.
Well,
which is really cynical.
I mean, yeah, it's cynical, and it's Roberts has this kind of conspiracy-fueled view of the world, apparently,
sure.
You know, and which I think says probably a lot about Roberts.
Sure.
You know, he lives in a world where there are pressure groups. There are the Koch brothers, and they have helped fund him and his buddies.
But then then Roberts can come out and say, I'm not closed-minded. I'm just not giving in to all those lobbying forces when I rule against DOMA.
Right.
When I rule to uphold, to keep DOMA in place, I'm not getting pushed around by those lobbyists.
Right.
But I'm still a good guy. Don't dislike me for being a bigot.
Right.
Or whatever.
When Louise and I went to see Olympus Has Fallen over the weekend, you know, this shoot 'em up movie, one of the previews was a preview for a new movie that's coming out. I think it's coming out this month. About Jackie Robinson,
mm-hmm.
and what kind of hell that man went through.
Sure.
Being the first black man
in
Major League Baseball.
The first of anything.
And you know, when I said the Jackie Robinson effect, I think that for the generation of white people in the, what was it, the 50s that Robinson, or is it the 60s? I don't know.
I think it may have been a little bit earlier, but I don't know off the top of my head.
Yeah, whenever it was. It happened before I was, you know, when I was fairly young. I'd have to go back and look when Robinson first started playing. But when that happened, initially there was some backlash, just like when, well, to this day, I suppose, gays coming out produces backlash. But there,
1947.
1947, thank you. Because, yeah, my recollection of it is, my youngest, earliest recollection of it is that it was already, you know, this was kind of
Brooklyn Dodgers,
a battle long fought long ago, yeah, that white people at that point, by the 50s and 60s, were starting to say, so what?
What's the big deal?
Yeah, yeah. And that's happening here. So, and you also had a clip of Justice Kennedy. This is
that's a swing vote, vote on the Supreme Court. And this, I just wanted to give one example of where he pretty much said, I don't know about this.
Right. The question is whether or not the federal government, under our federalism scheme, has the authority to regulate marriage.
And I will say that in other parts of the argument, he seemed to indicate, no, they don't.
Right. So. Right. We can regulate it. We can't, you know, the regulating of it would be up to the states. The federal government's job is to backstop the states. And if it does that, it has to do it under the 14th Amendment, at the very least, equal protection. It has to do it in a way that's consistent with everybody.
Right.
So this is probably going to be a 5-4 decision.
That's a good guess.
If it gets decided on the merits.
I would say yes, it's going to be decided on the merits, which will still be they'll probably issue a ruling on the jurisdictional question, which will probably be another 5-4 or 6-3, and then a 5-4 striking down DOMA.
Now, I'm guessing Clarence Thomas didn't say a word.
Not a word.
He's a man who is married to a woman who, and has been for 40 years, who 45 years ago could not have married that woman in the state in which they live in, Virginia, because she's white. And, you know, Loving versus Virginia, that was the state.
Yep.
And did you get any sense from his facial expressions, his body language?
None.
He was just impassive.
He did speak today, but was only delivering a decision. So.
Yeah, that was early on.
Yeah, it was early on. It was, you know, had nothing to do with this case.
Yeah. So. Did you get any sense from Alito or Breyer, you know, where they stand on this?
Breyer's pretty predictable. Yeah. Alito is one that you can't really decide based on his questions because he'll play devil's advocate.
Right.
He'll argue both sides. And a lot of times he's just quiet. You usually can tell by the scowl on his face, I'll be honest with you. That at the State of the Union, that's not a unique time for him to – he uses that face a lot.
Do you realize, Shano, how this conversation that you and I are having right now, how similar this conversation probably is – to a group of people 200, 300, 400 years ago sitting around having a conversation about, well, the king was meeting with his ministers today. Was he upset? Do we think he's going to go to, you know, is he going to go to war with the Bismarck or
was
not?
Was the king unamused? Not amused?
Yes.
Is someone going to lose their head over this?
We have a constitutional monarchy. I don't know if I've convinced you of this, but by day, I am more and more convincing myself.
Essentially, today they're going to judicially repeal an act of Congress because the president doesn't like it and thinks it's unconstitutional.
Right, and they're complaining about it.
But they probably will do it.
Right, and I don't, you know, this is this whole thing about judicial review.
There is a real separation of power issue here.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Very, very interesting. Let's pick up some phone calls here.
We have about 10 seconds to the music.
Oh, we just have 10 seconds to... Okay. Yeah. In that case, Pam, hang on. I'm going to put you back on hold. We'll pick up your call in a minute. So we'll see where this goes. I want to write a book on this whole judicial review thing, that we are... America is now a constitutional monarchy, and it wasn't designed that way. It's not in the Constitution. It wasn't what the founders had in mind. It really didn't even happen until the Civil War. Until just after the Civil War, really. And it largely happened in the 1870s and 1880s because the Supreme Court was corrupted, was literally bought out by the railroad barons. And here we are. Anyhow, 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, I was going to say live from the Supreme Court, but live just back from the Supreme Court. Shano and I talking about, I wasn't there, he was there, about what happened today. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations and coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, on every U.S. military base in the world, simulcast as television on both the Dish Network and DirecTV satellite systems and cable TV systems. Nationwide, more people watch or listen to this program on more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. And we are proud and pleased to have with us Congressman Mark Pocan, pocan.house.gov, his website, the Democrat representing the second district of Wisconsin. momentary brain fart there. Pardon me. Congressman Pocan, welcome back.
Hey, Tom. Thank you very much. Appreciate being here.
Great to have you. Shane and I have been talking. Shane was in the Supreme Court this morning listening to the arguments. I'm curious your take on what happened before the Supreme Court today. What's your take home on this?
Well, you know, my hope is that courts, and for that matter, the legislative bodies that we have at the U.S. government level will catch up with the public on this issue. You know, the most recent polling has shown 58% of the people in the state of Wisconsin, I'm sorry, in the country, are supporting marriage equality. And among 18 to 29-year-olds, we are literally at 81% of the people are supporting that. So clearly the public has already made a decision on this issue.
Right.
We just need to bring both the courts and our legislative bodies ahead. And I think that's why it's just so important that we're debating this yesterday.
You know, Justice Roberts today was arguing that there has been lobbying by the gay lobby, and that's why suddenly there's been this sea change in public opinion. I'm of the opinion that a lot of gay people made the very, very difficult decision that, for example, you made to just come out and say, here I am. And it has caused people to say, oh, in my family, my friends, my acquaintances, but, you know, straight people. And I think that, you know, there has been just this, you know, this explosion of coming out going on for the last, you know, decade and a half or so. And that is what's driving public opinion. What's your take on that?
Well, there's no question. You know, when someone knows someone, they're most likely to be supporting equality. And I think, you know, the fact that more and more people have come out, it's been more mainstream in popular culture. When people really understand that it's nothing more than two people who love each other and want to make a commitment to each other, and it's no different than any other marriage, we're win support. And I think that's really been the quest. So, you know, there's no question. People coming out and talking about this issue has made it so much more popular in the public.
Yeah, I agree. And so much popular, it made more popular the idea that gays should have every right to marry just like straights do, on the one hand, and on the other hand, has made it less of a consequential issue for things like as a barrier to jobs, to elected office, things like that.
No, exactly. Now, there's still, you know, we still have a lot of struggles to deal with to get full equality, you know, from really needing, you know, stronger employment non-discrimination laws and other things. You know, the marriage issue seems to be the biggest, most significant issue, because if we can really talk to people about why people should be treated equally, equal protection under the Constitution, it really sends a much stronger signal. And I think that's why this fight is so important and this week has been so important.
Yeah, I agree. I think this has the potential to be the Loving versus Virginia, you know, the end of miscegenation laws. Well, we'll see how it plays out with the Supreme Court, but it certainly looks that way. Congressman Pocan, a lot of our listeners and viewers remember you as the guy who was a state legislator in Wisconsin who was on our program as you were infiltrating the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC,
yep.
You know, this organization that gets together a couple times a year where they bring all these mostly Republican legislators in with lobbyists on a one-to-one basis and write laws for America. I'm curious, you know, got any updates for us on how the keeping track of ALEC is going?
Well, I'll tell you, I couldn't be more proud of a group right here in Madison, Wisconsin. The Center for Media and Democracy has been the watchdog nationally. They have ALECWatch.org, ALECExposed.org is their website. But they are the continual organization that's keeping an eye. And now there are more and more legislators doing what I have been doing, Tom, just kind of reaching out and exposing what they're doing state by state. With the 2010 elections, the Republicans were in control of as many majorities as they were at their peak in 1928. That's why they've been so aggressive, but they've also been overstepping and just taking these bills without doing any changes and misintroducing them. And I think we're having some real success between the Trayvon Martin case and the coalition now that's behind here. We're really getting out there to the point that we're exposing them and making it a lot harder for ALEC to operate like they have in so long.
Now, ALEC has been, you know, working with the Republicans to use things like racism and fear to gain legislative victories with the so-called Stand Your Ground laws, although you could argue that there's a commercial interest at stake there, which is, I guess, really what ALEC is supposed to be doing is, you know, supporting their lobbyists. And the voter ID laws, you know, let's not let black people vote. I'm curious, do you know if ALEC has been involved in any of the anti-gay marriage laws?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Technically, they don't get involved in social issues, but when you go to the conference, and it was just last year, I was at the one in Salt Lake City, you know, they have booths for the NRA. They have booths for a number of anti-choice organizations. They have booths for the traditional marriage group that's out there. So they clearly are marrying the two concepts through the conference, just not necessarily in their workshops, but they know that the power that they have for corporate wealth is to marry the social conservatives with those who are just trying to take advantage of the system financially. So it's tied in, even though it's not necessarily part of their model legislation. It's definitely part of their conferences and how they bring people together.
That's amazing. This is the, you know, Tom, I'm forgetting his last name, wrote, you know, What's the Matter with Kansas? And you know, What's the Matter with Kansas is that scared white people, by and large, are being, you know, frightened by these you know, right-wing conservatives to vote against their own economic interests. And Alec has been leading that charge. It's really quite remarkable.
Now, the next step, though, to watch is, at least I've noticed it, and I've tried to talk to some folks about it, is we notice there's a new group, and I'm forgetting the name of it right now, out of Alexandria, Virginia, that is basically a clearinghouse to take all the groups that quit funding ALEC. They can now give money to this group, and then it makes nonprofit donations makes donations to groups like ALEC and other conservative front groups.
Huh.
And it's a way to launder their money so that they're not directly giving it to a group like ALEC. So we are trying to also keep an eye on that, Tom, because
that's
this
great.
Is just a backdoor way of funding it. We can't let that happen either.
There you go. Congressman Mark Pocan, fighting the good fight, pocan.house.gov. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, thank you, Tom.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on the Free Speech TV Network via Dish and DirecTV satellite systems and cable systems all around the country. Matt Taibbi on the line with us. Contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine, the author of five books, most recently Griftopia, Bubble Machines, Vampires, Squids, and The Long Con That Is Breaking America. And Matt, you've got a new piece up at Rolling Stone over at rollingstone.com. Welcome to the program.
How are you doing, Tom?
Great to have you back with us. Tell us about this this new article that you've written that starts off with the you thought WikiLeaks was a big deal.
Well, yeah, I had a call from a friend of mine, Alex Gibney, who's the director who made Client 9 and The Smartest Guys in the Room, and he was just is this brilliant documentary filmmaker, and you know, he asked me to go see his new film about WikiLeaks, which I've only been kind of tangentially following the last couple of years, and I went to see this movie, and it's an incredible movie. And I started, it's funny, I've been hearing, I get a lot of calls from whistleblowers and, you know, people connected to the finance industry, but I've also, in the last 6 months or so, I started to hear from a lot of people who are hackers or who are involved in that world, who are concerned about, you know, these very heavy duty prosecutions of people like Aaron Schwartz, and so, you know, it occurred to me to just sort of ruminate on this idea of what's going to happen the next time around when you know, it's not the United States versus Julian Assange, but the United States versus, you know, everybody, because that's what it's going to be the next time around. It's going to be you know, not a single individual that they're able to successfully discredit, but there's going to be a real clash over all these digitized secrets that are coming out about the rottenness of our culture.
Yeah, to what extent? Well, let me just, you know, tell you a little bit of a story. We had back maybe a little more than a year ago. In fact, it must No, it was considerably more than a year ago. It was when WikiLeaks was first, you know, really out there, and it was during the Bush administration. It was during the last year of the Bush administration. So it was like 5 years ago. As I recall, we were contacted by somebody who represented themselves as being part of a hackers group that had inside information, quack, quack, quack. Did we want to get involved? Did we want to help them? All this guy. And it just so seemed to me, I was literally getting flashbacks. I was in SDS in the 1960s at Michigan State University. And I, you know, when we got the Red Squad files from the Michigan State Police in the early 70s and discovered that the guy who had been the guy who was always saying, we need to firebomb the buildings, we need to kill the pig, you know, it turns out that he was the police informant. When this person contacted us, I backed away from it so fast and so far because I just thought, am I being set up here? I mean, what's going on? I'm curious your thoughts on that and what kind of experience you've had and any other journalists. I mean, there has been a real chill in, you know, I think anybody in this business, anybody in the media business, and particularly with anybody with any kind of profile has to be, probably has had similar experiences and has to be a little bit freaked about all this.
Absolutely. I think what happened to Bradley Manning and Julian Assange, but particularly to Manning and to Aaron Swartz and to some other people, less well known, like Sergei Aleinikov, who's the guy who stole allegedly Goldman Sachs' secret trading code. There's all this digitized information out there. There's all these secrets, and we do hear from whistleblowers all the time. And what they're essentially asking us to do is to get in the line of fire for them, take the legal heat for any consequences that might come for publishing damaging or embarrassing information. But you know, that's our job. I look at it as if somebody comes to me with information about corruption and we're able to validate it and find out that it's true and find out that the source is real, then, you know, it's our job to stand.
Oh, I don't disagree with that. And yeah. Absolutely.
The problem is you're absolutely right. It's impossible. Well, it's not impossible. It's very, very difficult to tell who's who.
Yeah.
In this new landscape, and
particularly when somebody says, "If you'll just help me do this, then together we can get to that."
Mm-hmm, right. Yeah. Exactly.
And it's like, you know, come be a co-conspirator with me. Oh, really?
Right. Right.
And this, I, you know, this is the I maybe we're getting away a bit from the essence of your article, but just this kind of brave new world that we're moving into.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Let me let you go off on it.
No, I think you're absolutely right. It's very, very difficult, and complicating matters are these very, very extreme prosecutions of these people. I mean, you know, Bradley Manning, who I see as a classic whistleblower. I don't think there's any question in my mind that clearly the guy had problems and he was motivated by a lot of things.
And he did it poorly and badly from a legal point of view, but he knew that you know, these two journalists had been murdered by the U.S. military in an illegal operation.
Among thousands of other things.
Right.
I mean, you know, he like a lot of people in Iraq, knew about terrible things that were going on, and it was – look, I've known a lot of whistleblowers. They all have something in common. Almost all of them are emotionally unstable people. It's part of the profile. One of the reasons that they end up becoming the way they are is because they're alienated in some way from the people that they work with, and so they start taking a critical eye at what they're doing. And so that's just part of the makeup of your typical whistleblower. I think Bradley Manning to me. It's a classic whistleblower. He's just a guy who had a lot of problems and didn't get along with people he worked with, and he was just looking at this crazy, horrible stuff and realizing that he was a part of it.
And I think you could argue that the founding fathers of this country were whistleblowers at a certain level. They were the, instead of calling them emotionally unstable, we should call them the malcontents of society, a word that was actually celebrated by Apple Computer at one time.
Right. No, but I mean, look, I don't know. I mean, I've dealt with a lot of people who, you know, have come forward and have tried to, you know, publish embarrassing information about big companies. And yes, you can see in a lot of the cases that these are people who, if they were your coworkers, you know, they might be a little bit of a handful. You know, they're not. There's something else going on there besides just, you know, somebody who came across something morally questionable. There's always another element to the story that the government looks at and uses to discredit the source of the information.
Unfortunately,
but ultimately it comes down to, is this information in the public interest?
Right.
And if it is, you have an obligation to do something about it. And that's where I think.
And yet our government is increasingly saying, no, you can't.
Right. That's what they're saying. They're trying to change the definition of what whistleblowing is. I mean,
right.
I think they're just saying, if you take this information, under any circumstances, we're going to call it X.
Right. And what the press is who publishes it. Which is
right.
What's happened to Julian Assange. Matt Taibbi, contributing editor of the Rolling Stone magazine, rollingstone.com. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Great talking.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And check out Matt's new article over at rollingstone.com. It's brilliant. 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Kelly in Lake Havasu City, Arizona. Hey, Kelly, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
How are you doing today, Tom?
Great. What's up?
My question for you is, if Robert says that this is a lobbied fake movement, then how can they stand on Citizens United?
Right. Yeah, if what that says to you, it's like people who rob people are always on the lookout for being robbed, you know.
I mean, to me, it just expresses the guilt.
Yeah, I think what Robert's by saying that his worldview is that things only happen in the political world when money moves things, when a lobbying group gets rich enough that they can move things. What he is confessing is that A, he played a role in that, and B, he certainly has been influenced by that. And having been a $2 million a year corporate attorney before he was put on the Supreme Court, you know, it's probably consistent not just with his worldview, but with his experience, his actual experience. So, I think you're right, Kelly. It does say a lot about him. Thanks for the call. Jay in Oswego, Illinois. Hey, Jay, what's up? Thanks for listening to WCP.
Hey, how's it going? Like Colin, I've talked to you before. Hey, I want to bring up a point here, and I want to be vocal, just as everyone is in this case, and say I'm a Christian, I'm a believer. We look at division of church and state. So let's get some clarity here. I would say, as a Christian, what my concern is not benefits, but the sacrament of marriage here. And I don't have clarity from the other side of the aisle as far as, is it all about benefits or is it about, and I would call it the desecration of a sacrament. Which one is more important here? Because then you have a battle on your hands with Christians if it's all about trashing the sanctity of marriage. If it's about benefits, hey, Christian, pretty much mantra is don't love the world and the things in it. So frankly, I don't have a problem with someone in a civil union that wants all the same benefits that I have in a marriage.
Let me reassure you then, Jay. If you're Catholic, for example, and you're married, you cannot get divorced. Because that sacrament, unless the church decides that you never had sex, that sacrament is solid. Right. If you are Jewish and you want to get married in many of the Jewish synagogues, you can't marry somebody who's not Jewish, who hasn't been, you know, if you're in many Protestant denominations, if you're a member of a particular denomination, you know, the Latter-day Saints, I'm pretty sure if you're Mormon and you want to marry somebody and they haven't converted to Mormonism, the church is not going to recognize that marriage. So the sacramental part of marriage and, frankly, the kind of anti-sacramental part of divorce, all of that is still totally in the hands of churches and synagogues and temples and whatever you want to call it. The government is making no decisions, right? The Catholic Church probably does not recognize, you know, I don't know their official position on it, but Newt Gingrich, I believe, has converted to Catholicism. I don't understand how they could recognize his second and third marriage, both of which happened from affairs he was having while he was married to his previous wife.
Well, look at a bigger standard we're holding here. Forget the hypocrisy. I know it runs rampant, okay, and none of us are perfect. We're all sinners.
You're missing my point, Jay.
What I'm saying is this, that if we put it and frame it that way, could it be that the other side of the aisle in this case, and that's what I'm saying, anyone supporting gay marriage would have to come out and say, all right, you got us. We're trying to change what God said. That's what it's about.
Nobody's saying that. No, you know, I mean, now there are some denominations. There are some denominations. The United Church of Christ has come out and said, we believe that gay marriage is consistent with Jesus's message. And they've held that position for almost a decade.
They're all wrong, and they're all going against what God said.
Everybody claims they have a monopoly on what God said. But the constitutional position is that it's not the business of government to decide what God said. And so, a church can recognize a marriage or not. The sacramental part of a marriage, the sacred part of the marriage, that's up to the churches. What we're talking about here is contract law. We're talking about two people saying, when I die, you get my stuff.
They got to get the word marriage out of there then. And then it should behoove.
Well, no, the word marriage is part of contract law. At law, the word marriage means contract. In church, or in a synagogue, or in a temple, or in a mosque, the word marriage means something quite different.
Right, but I think that's the debate. So the point I would make, that's the bone of contention. So the point is quite simple. Instead of, don't you think it's harder what they're trying to reconstruct and affect the Constitution? No, you know what, just...
No, they're not. And Shane just pointed out to me, neither the word Bible nor the word God was ever brought up in the Supreme Court pleadings, either yesterday or today at the United States Supreme Court. There was no, absolutely no discussion about the religious dimension of this. That is not the business of government. There is, the Establishment Clause in the Constitution says the government shall not establish any religious test for public office. And the First Amendment says that there shall be no official religion for the United States, essentially.
The country we have, though, is that everything's predicated upon in God we trust.
No, in God we trust is not in the Constitution. It's not in the Declaration of Independence.
It's
something that was put on our coins in 1953.
Right. And the presidents all say, God bless America.
Yeah.
The country's a little confused. I'm a little confused on which one is it? Is God in our country or not? I guess that's the real question here.
No, we have a secular republic. George Washington was very clear about that. George Washington refused.
A lot of people have been misled.
We have a secular republic. We are a government of laws. We are not a government of religions. And
well, then why does the president invoke God's name at when it's convenient?
Because he finds it politically expedient.
But don't you agree then that is hypocritical and that should probably stop too then?
You could make that argument, and a lot of atheists do. A lot of people who aren't atheists think it's kind of cool that the president, mentions their particular god or their favorite god or whatever.
I think it's deceptive. In my estimation, it's deceptive. I'd rather don't be lukewarm, and that's...
Yeah, like Thomas Jefferson and just, Jefferson was just open about it, right? I mean, he took the New Testament and with a razor blade, cut out all the miracles and then reassembled it. And it's still in print, the Jefferson Bible. No miracles, Jesus, right? He was just a wise philosopher. And, he said, enough of these dusty books. This is paraphrasing, but it's pretty close. He said, when we started this country, we didn't have to look into dusty books or, ancient scripts. We looked into the laws of nature and found them written in our hearts. Jay, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And by the way, I would say things have changed since that day, because back then, one of the laws of nature he was talking about was slavery. Welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour, or 34 minutes after, or whatever. However, whatever that all works out to. Marilyn in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Marilyn, what's up?
Oh, hi there.
You want to talk about WikiLeaks?
Tom. Yes, I'm just wondering why WikiLeaks is sitting back with all the power they have shown that they have. and allowing the whistleblowers to be criminalized and harshly punished, when I think a blitzkrieg of information released to the public would be very happily received by the public and would also send a serious message to the fascists who are suppressing information that is rightfully ours.
I don't disagree if the corporate media would pick it up. I mean, they did that in the early case. This the video that Bradley Manning apparently dropped through WikiLeaks that I think he's now confessed to, that showed the two AP reporters along with a number of civilians being murdered by, you know, some helicopter fighter pilots. I think they were helicopter pilots, you know, guys in a helicopter. That at the time was embraced by the media, but the media by and large has not been embracing information that WikiLeaks has been putting out. They've been avoiding it. And there has been this full court press to go after the whistleblowers. So WikiLeaks may have less information available. There's been an effort to cut off the funding for WikiLeaks. You had the large credit card companies, you know, all said, no, we're not going to fund WikiLeaks. When a secondary group was put together to kind of route money through to WikiLeaks, you know, we featured them on the program for a couple of days, but they just kind of dropped off the radar. So I think that what we really need is for our legislators to take seriously the importance of whistleblowers and bring back the legislation that we did have at one point in this republic that said that, you know, being a whistleblower actually gives you immunities and protections. And, you know, I realize that there is some legislation to that effect on the books right now, but it's nowhere near as strong as it needs to be. And we need to stop this insane persecution of Julian Assange and, you know, we're going to get this guy, we're going to take him down, all this kind of stuff. I think it's just wrong. Marilyn, thank you for the call. Julia in Angel Fire, New Mexico. Hey, Julia, what's up? Julia? I think Julia just vanished. Nancy in Renton, Washington. Hey, Nancy, you have a DOMA story?
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. It's been a while since I've talked to you, Tom, and I certainly want to thank you for helping our cause along by discussing this on your program today. Sure. I'll try to make my story of my life as short as possible here. You also had a guest on yesterday. I think his name was Peter Sager. He was against marriage equality.
Right.
And so my story begins with my birth into basically a domestic violence situation back in the 50s. My mother was Catholic, and of course we were raised Catholic. And my father, when I was in school at the age of 9, my father shot my mother, and so she died from those wounds.
Wow.
And in just as a side note, I'm really in for the gun control laws as well in this country.
I can understand.
And we were raised by my mother's relatives, and I feel that As I grew up, I recognized my sexuality at the age of about 7 or 8 years old. And when I was old enough, I served in the military and spent 20 years there and retired out. I married my partner of 14 years this past December 9th of 2012 in the state of Washington as soon as we were able to.
Your partner, who is also a woman, I'm assuming.
Excuse me?
I'm assuming your partner is also a woman. That's the...
Yes, sir, that is correct. And we were together 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
And to answer, I guess, a few of the questions that one of the earlier callers, I believe Kelly, it might have been, we're looking for not just equality for ourselves, but... You know, I want my partner to be able to have the federal benefits that I receive from the military.
Yep.
Even if she weren't to use them, at least she would be able to have them if anything should happen to me.
Right. And under Washington state law, she should be, but under federal law, because of DOMA,
correct,
she can't.
That is correct. And that is why we would like to see DOMA be done away with.
Yeah.
And So as it is right now, under Washington state laws, when we do our taxes here, our tax system for her and I to do it is kind of modeled after what they had in the California state laws down there. I can't explain it all because it gets really into the mud on that. So, and I'm not an expert on.
But at the state level, for state tax purposes, you are married. For federal tax purposes, you are not. Is that accurate? Okay.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
That is correct.
Yeah. This seems like just such a simple thing, and it blows my mind that John Roberts would make the argument in court today that the reason why Americans are increasingly accepting of gay couples, people like yourself, who are out and living out, is because some gay lobby out there threw a bunch of money into it. When in fact, what it is that people like yourself are saying, "Here I am." In my opinion, I'm curious your take on that.
Yes, for myself, it is confusing to people that. I'm not really sure of how to explain it all, but it just being able to be out where I was not being able to be out while I was in the service.
Right.
It brings such a wholeness to myself as a person, and that's what I feel like. That's what we feel like. It brings a wholeness to us, just as being human beings, shall I say.
Yeah. Oh, you said it so brilliantly, Nancy. And now let's let your partner inherit and share in your military benefits from the 20 years of service you gave to this nation, as would your partner if your partner was a man would be able to. It's crazy that your partner, who's a woman, can't. And
That's correct. I'm also a single mother, and in speaking to your guest on yesterday, it doesn't always take a man and a woman to raise a child. I also had friends and family support to help me with my son when I was in the military and I was away because I was in the Navy and the Coast Guard. They helped me to raise my son,
right,
you know, by being there for supporting him when I was, you know, underway doing my job in serving my country.
Mm-hmm.
And he's grown to be a good young man, and he is actually teaching in the Middle East in Bahrain at one of their, I think it's on the same level as a community college. They call it the Polytechnic Academy.
Mm-hmm.
So he's teaching over there, and, you know, he's being useful to the world at large, shall I say.
That's great. You've raised a son you're proud of, and the world should be proud of. And again, he should have two parents who legally have the rights to be parents.
That's correct. And just in case anybody would really like to know what I would say a lesbian couple, I'm sure maybe some folks have seen it, maybe yourself also. Zach Walls, the young man from the University of Iowa, I believe it was, spoke to the Iowa Supreme Court at the time. It was a few years ago. Very well-spoken man, young man, and that clip was on.
He was the young man who was raised by two mothers.
That's correct. He and his biological sister, yes.
Right.
And so if they choose to really want to educate themselves, look at that clip and just see how well he could be, you know, he was raised by two people that weren't just a man and a woman.
And then, Nancy, you get people who say, well, wait a minute, this, you know, if we acknowledge gay people as being married, somehow that makes a straight marriage less sacred. It seems to me that what you have is sacred.
Well, it's sacred to us, but it's not in a religious way. This is just about human nature. It's how we treat one another.
Right.
And my grandmother, who was a God-fearing Catholic and also had that influence on me after my mother had died, told me that she said that God knew who I was as a person, the person that he made before I was born.
Mm-hmm.
She told me that as a young child, and that made such an impression on me. I've never forgotten that.
Yeah.
But it's not about the religion. It's about just how we treat one another as people.
Amen. And frankly, I would say that that is a sacred piece of life. It's how we treat each other, how we recognize each other. Nancy, thank you so much for the call.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for having me on. Bye.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. DOMA argued before the Supreme Court today. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of the goat and the person you helped. Hey, Bob.
Hello. How are you, Tom?
Great to have you with us in the studio today. Nice to see you.
Yes,
so what's going on in the news?
Well, of course, the big news of the day is DOMA. I was over the Supreme Court with Helen Ratner. Very interesting. Outside was as interesting, I think, as the inside with the signs and the protests. But the questions, because some of the questions that were asked, I mean, there's speculation five justices already are going to overturn the entire thing. But I think that the interesting part of this is it's a tax case also.
Yeah.
Well, it really is.
I mean, this is really about if somebody is married in a state that recognizes gay marriage, they pay married taxes as a married person in that state. But at the federal level, they're paying taxes as a single person and inheritance rights and federal benefits rights and federal pension rights and military benefits and pension, all these kinds of things, which really have to do with tax law and money.
That doesn't mean that won't indirectly affect DOMA as it functions and as it operates, but part of it could be gutted. And the tax perspective, I thought, was very, very fascinating. But the comments of the justices, Alito, who said, this is as new as the Internet. And you're hearing, you know, some of the comments that I think it's some uncharted territory in a sense in some of the minds of the justices due to the law itself, but also due to the tax part.
Interesting. Okay. What
and
else
then,
is
of
going
course,
on?
Julia Pearson, I think, is big news today. Maybe it's not getting
Julia
all the
Pearson?
Julia, new head of the Secret Service.
Oh.
Julia Pearson.
Okay. The
we
woman.
Have the first
that
female.
Right.
Two good news points. The first female in the history of Secret Service. She's a career Secret Service employee. And the second is the Senate doesn't have to confirm this.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Is does this have to go to the
that's
Senate?
That's the second piece of good news.
Here we, you know, we just had, for example, this fellow, I'm forgetting his name, but President Obama had appointed him to the First Circuit Court of Appeals 4.5 years ago. And, you know, that's kind of the holding pen, the bullpen for the Supreme Court. And he's a brilliant jurist, and he just gave up last week. Said, "That's it, I'm leaving," because they've been filibustering his you know, I mean, there's like 3 or 4 empty seats on that court.
Oh, of course,
you know, and they keep filibustering it to maintain a 4-3 balance on the Republican side, which is wrong.
That's right.
I mean, it's just plain old wrong.
It's just the system in the Senate is so antiquated.
Yeah.
And two other things: the Obamacare glitch, as they're calling it. And I wanted to bring this up because Families USA Today, an influential healthcare advocacy group, is saying, well, there's a glitch and millions of Americans will be priced out of the health insurance market. But I think that one of the points of the Obamacare bill is that this bill is designed by the nature of Congress, those who supported the bill. It's designed for the bureaucratic side to come back and as a new bill to continue the rulemaking process to correct glitches or to tweak the bill. It wasn't a bill that was made in perfection that this is what would be done. So there shouldn't be a lot of shock, especially when you hear an advocacy group, quote, coming out with this, which might be more of a scare angle. It can be corrected.
So the backstory of this is that there is a small group of people who actually are, because of Obamacare, are actually going to have to pay more for their health care. And this is something that could be easily remedied with a very small act of Congress. But instead of the Republican House of Representatives saying, oh, we'll fix that or we'll enable you to fix that on a regulatory basis, we'll fund that, they're saying, no, we're not going to fund it. We're just going to stand around and scream about it. Do I have that right?
Yes, because if this was a law, let's take No Child Left Behind. Right. Which, you know, the Speaker of the House had authored when he was a regular member. Mm-hmm. And I mention that because as things came down the pike and they were screaming, he would say, well, we'll stand to correct that if that's a problem.
Right.
With a bill that you don't have the majority party supporting, then the rulemaking process will have to come back through to tweak these and to correct.
Right. So the bottom line is that the Republicans will continue to scream about this problem with Obamacare that they could easily fix, but they're going to refuse to fix it.
Because a good, I think, tactic to take for public policy would be, look, we don't like the bill, et cetera, but we've got it right here, and unless we're going to do away with it, we're going to correct it.
Right, but they're not going to do that.
Well, I don't think that'll happen.
Yeah, okay.
That's in a dream world, though.
That's a tragic commentary on the state of political discourse in America right now.
Well, I think it's a tough arena right now.
Yeah, it is. Anyhow, what else is up?
Well, the only other thing that is of major international significance, I think, not only is the verbiage up from North Korea, which rises and falls at their will, mm-hmm. but the hotline is cut. And I think that's significant. They have a hotline, as we had with the Nixon, you know, Khrushchev days,
right.
The hotline, and it's been cut. And then the ramping up of the verbiage from North Korea preparing for war. But the complete now cutoff of the military country to country, I think, is a significant.
Have you seen the movie Olympus Has Fallen?
I just saw it three nights ago.
Yeah, Louise and I saw it Sunday night. And,
I saw that.
And you know, it's a good, dumb, fun movie. I mean, I'm not
exactly
trying to pretend that, like, unlike Les Mis or Django, which I thought were both, you know, these are movies that people should see just so that they have some education about, you know, the era of the French Revolution or the era of slavery. This is just a dumb, fun movie. But one of the things we know about Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, is that he's a junkie for these kind of American movies.
That's right.
And this movie plays the North Koreans as evil bad guys who almost destroy the United States.
Right.
I got this personal theory that he's just crazy enough that this movie might have set him off.
And you know, we
do you think
that
there's any possibility to that?
Well, it might. I mean, the guy does this. He's fascinated with Xbox and certain other things. And we know he's just a strange man. At first, we thought, well, he's a little younger, maybe. He'll do more, but he's
yeah.
just out there.
He went
there.
To Switzerland to school.
He went to Switzerland.
Said,
we're going to have a whole change.
Sophisticated.
He's just out there.
Yeah.
As much as
I think it has
previous.
To. I mean, his grandfather was basically defined as a god, mm-hmm. you know, as the father of the race of the, you know, the Koreans. And then his father inherited that mantle, and he was raised knowing that he was a prince in this semi-divine order. And had to believe from the time he was a very young child that this was the way that, you know, the universe was organized, or this is the way God wanted it, to be able to see the suffering in his country contrasted with the lavish lifestyle that his family had. That has to warp a kid's perspective.
I would assume.
You know, I think we saw that. It's Louis XVI syndrome. I think that it has.
In fact, the personal thoughts up here that can influence a country.
There you go. It's pretty amazing. Anyhow, Bob Nay with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Check out goatsfortheoldgoat.com to help out a rescued slave, which is the underwriter for Talk Radio News. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, maybe we've come to some kind of a we've figured out moment.
Maybe.
Science and politics agree? Check this out. All around the world, I'm going to sneeze in just a second here. All around the world, people are wondering, excuse me, out loud, people are wondering out loud, why does America have a gun problem when Canada and Europe don't? I mean, Canadians and Europeans, they watch the same violent movies. Many Canadians and Swiss even have easier access to guns than most Americans. You live in a big American city in New York. I mean, strong gun controls, Washington, D.C. It's much harder to get access to a gun than, you know, in Switzerland. You member of the militia, you've got to have a gun. But only America seems to have so many men buying guns, hoarding guns, and discharging guns. Could it be that we have a psychology problem here? Or could it be that it's more than that? What would Freud say about all this? You know, the famous psychiatrist may well have found interesting a line of research performed and published repeatedly over the past decade that shows like that chemicals like bisphenol A are widespread in the American food supply, but generally not as widespread or are even banned in Canada and Europe. As Nature magazine noted in an article titled, U.S. Opts Not to Ban BPA in Canned Foods, these are quotes from the article, BPA mimics the hormone estrogen even in low doses. Estrogen, of course, is the hormone that makes girls into girls and women into women. And what happens to men when they take estrogen? Their penises get smaller. As Yahoo News reported, a study in Canada found that estrogen-mimicking chemicals definitely can affect penis size. The article headlined, Bisphenol A may cause smaller penises, notes, and I quote, peer-reviewed science, good article, this new research regarding bisphenol A influencing smaller genitals and penises in male humans may be a sizable problem for men already worried about the size of their nether regions, end quote. The article's author, Penny Richards, further notes that scientists in Canada studied penis sizes and BPA exposure levels in thousands of children and found a clear relationship between BPA exposure and smaller penises. She wrote, quote, this news relating to small penis size and BPA comes on the heels of past tests. The scientific community has long known that rodents dosed with chemicals such as BPA have given birth to feminized male babies. Effects include smaller genital tracts in the male mice. The new Canadian study also follows recent reports by scientists in the United States who reported that they noticed smaller penises in boys from moms who had high levels of BPA. End of quote. So BPA, it's mostly banned in Canada and Europe. But here in the United States, hey, they have lobbyists. They own Congress members. It's everywhere, especially in fast food restaurants. Pretty much, you know, all those sauces, all that, you know, that secret sauce and that ketchup and all that. Pretty much anything liquid that came into a fast food restaurant came in a can that was probably lined with BPH or a giant box, including, you know, the house wine. It comes in a giant box, is lined with a plastic bag that's made with BPA. And Americans, especially gun-loving Americans, seem to have a strong affection for fast food. And BPA is only one of dozens of estrogen-mimicking chemicals in the American food supply that pretty much don't appear in the Canadian or European food supplies because they don't allow these estrogen mimickers to be in their food. So you mix up a few of these things through a lifetime, and you end up with really, really small penises. So back to Freud. What would Sigmund Freud say about a nation filled with men whose penises are getting smaller and smaller because their food supply is laced with estrogen-mimicking chemicals? Might they start turning in large numbers to long things that look like big penises and can produce awe-inspiring eruptions when their triggers are tickled? Well, the idea of such a problem was never really presented to Sigmund Freud because such chemicals didn't exist back in his day, or if they did, we didn't know about them. But his widely known penis envy theory, you can extrapolate that, any modern psychotherapist. I don't think it's malpractice for me to put my psychotherapist hat on and say, yeah, I think we can conclude that Freud would probably be on board with the idea that men who worry about the size and functionality of their equipment might find ways to compensate, like by buying, using, and displaying, and fetishizing, frankly, long, thin things that can have something come out of the end, like cigars and guns. Freud, of course, you know, famously said, sometimes a good cigar is just a good cigar. He actually, you know, he's kind of misquoted in that. He actually said, a pipe is just a pipe, but meaning is the same. Presumably most rational gun owners are just rational gun owners. They're not men freaked out about shrinking penises. But what about those guys who seem to obsess on these things? Let's leave the final word on that to the internationally known commentator on sociological conditions, Jim Carrey. In a recent video for Funny or Die, he sings near the end that, and here's the words, I'm going to play it for you in just a second, but it's pretty fast. He says, as near as I can figure, you're a big, big man with a little bitty gland, so you need something bigger with a hair-thin trigger. Here he is.
Cold and hand, cold. so you need something bigger with a hairpin trigger. You don't want to get caught with your trousers down when the psycho killer comes around.
So you make your Could it be? Makes perfect sense to me. So, anyhow, I just something to arouse the people who are concerned about guns. I just couldn't pass it up. Jim Carrey produced this incredibly funny video, and in it he plays Charlton Heston, and asserts that Charlton Heston did not get into heaven because he, you know, wouldn't let go of his gun, and apparently heaven's a gun-free zone. And there are people reacting to it as if Charlton Heston was a saint and this was blasphemy. So I thought I would riff on it a little bit. Anyhow, back to SCOTUS land. Glenn in Westerville, Ohio. Hey, Glenn, you're a Lutheran minister?
Yes, thank you very much. I'm very honored that you would take my call. Yes, I'm a Lutheran minister. It's a specialized ministry. I make movies and any sorts of mass media for the church, mm-hmm. and also other nonprofit groups. But also then, if a pastor is gone from the parish on a conference or vacation or the like, I'll then fill in and lead worship.
Mm-hmm. So your thoughts on the separation of church and state gay marriage?
I am very, very, first of all, I'm very, very strongly believe in the separation of church and church to state. And I don't think, for instance, this business of taking public taxpayer money to underwrite Christian-based schools, I think is fraudulent. I mean, it's right. up to Christians ourselves to raise that kind of money to have that education.
So are you of the opinion that DOMA should be knocked down?
I'm sorry?
Are you of the opinion that DOMA should be knocked down?
Absolutely. I want DOMA knocked down. I'm very, very pro-gay. I'm happily married with my wife. I'm straight myself, but we've tons of gay friends, and I've spoken. I was in a series of debates with a very mixed group, but I took a postmodern argument versus the fundamentalist argument.
Right. The Bronze Age argument. Yeah, Glenn. Well, I'm sorry, we're out of time, but thank you for calling, and thank you for being a rational Lutheran minister. It's wonderful. Not that most Lutheran ministers aren't rational. Everyone I've ever known is a wonderful person. Thank you for the call. Thanks for sharing your perspective.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Should the Supreme Court even have the power to decide this? Okay, so George calls and says, why do we have marriage laws in the United States? Why do you have to have a marriage license in all but one state, apparently? And, you know, it's pretty straightforward stuff. Let me just lay it out. This is from my book on equal protection. I'm on page 123, and I'll just, you know, share part of this with you. This was, it started out, actually, with Abigail Adams, John Adams' wife, sending him a letter while he is at the drafting convention in 1787. He's drafting the Constitution. And she sends him a letter that says, remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than were their ancestors. And he sends back a letter to her saying, depend on it that we know better than to repeal our masculine systems. So she gets really, really upset. In fact, Alexander Hamilton writes this whole piece in the Federalist Papers about the dangers of the intrigues of courtesans and mistresses. And so Abigail Adams writes back to John. She says, if particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion. And in response to that, Richard Henry Lee, on June 7th, 1776, proposes a resolution saying that the colonies shall be free and independent states governed solely by free men. So here was the status. A married woman was, this is why marriage licenses, because women were the property of men. And there had to be some way to define that property, to define when the ownership of that property begins, when the ownership of that property ends. This is the history of marriage, right? This was at the time of the founding of the Republic, 1787. A married woman was not allowed to make out a will because she was not allowed to own land or legally control anything else worthy of willing to another person. Any property she brought into a marriage became her husband's at the moment of marriage and would revert to her only if he died and she did not remarry. But even then, she would only get one-third of her husband's property, and what third that was and how she could use it were determined by a male court-appointed executor who would supervise her for the rest of her life or until she remarried with regard to how she used that third of her husband's estate that she had inherited. When a widow died, the executor would either take the property for himself or decide to whom it would pass. The woman would have no say in the matter because she had no right to sign a will. Women could not sue in a court of law except under the same weak procedures allowed for the mentally ill and for children supervised and represented by men. If the man of the family household died, the executor could decide who would raise the wife's children and in what religion. She had no right to make those decisions, even though she's still alive and she's still a mom, and no say in such matters. If the woman was poor, it was a virtual certainty that her children would be taken from her. And finally, it was impossible in the new United States of America for a married woman to have legal responsibility for her children, to control her own property, to buy or sell land, or even obtain an ordinary license. And this is where it gets so ironic, because in the 14th Amendment, the word male is in the 14th Amendment. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton wrote in 1886, and I quote, this is from her letter, "If the word male be inserted into this amendment, it will take a century to get it out." And she was right. That was 1866, and it was 1963 that the Equal Pay Act was passed. In 1964, the Civil Rights Act was passed, which required equal pay for women and men and prohibited discrimination against women by any company with more than 24 employees. But, you know, remember, 1873, Bradwell versus Illinois. Susan Bradwell, I believe, was her first name. And she became a lawyer, and she went into a court of law and said, okay, I'm here to represent somebody. And the judge looked down and said, no, you have to leave, you're a woman. So she sued. She took that to the Supreme Court. And in Bradwell versus Illinois, 1873, the Supreme Court ruled, and I quote, "The family institution is repugnant to the idea of a woman adopting a distinct and independent career from that of her husband. So firmly fixed was this sentiment in the founders of the common law that it became a maxim of that system of jurisprudence that a woman has no legal existence separate from her husband, who was regarded as her head and representative in the social state." Equality of, you know, so it's just, that was it, right? She lost. When, you know, actually, I think it was Sarah Bradwell. I don't have her name in here, but it was Bradwell versus Illinois. And women didn't really get those rights until the 1920s, and they're still fighting for all those rights. So what's so ironic is that, you know, when we look at the whole, this whole arc, this whole history, and now we're talking about the rights of gays, it's like every step along the way, it was at the time that women were considered property of their husbands, at least they were well-treated property of their husbands. Slaves were, by and large, poorly treated property of the white men. And I mean, you look back at this history and you go, holy cow, I mean, this country was like birthed in bizarre patriarchy. I mean, just a bizarre patriarchy. And now you've got these bizarre patriarchs. You know, John Boehner in the House of Representatives taking this organization called BLAG, this kind of Republican ad hoc lawyer group, and saying, we're going to take taxpayer money and hire a private lawyer, and you're going to go out and argue in favor of DOMA, because the president and the attorney general won't. And so BLAG takes this to the Supreme Court.
and says, no, gay people should not have rights.
We have seen this movie twice now. We saw it with women, and we saw it with African Americans. Well, actually, we've seen it three times, and we've seen it with white and African American couples, mixed race couples who wanted to marry. It just seems to me like this is what we are looking at. You know, it's actually, instead of getting indignant about it, I should be celebrating it. What we are seeing right in front of us as we are talking. I mean, this is like one of those moments. This is one of those moments that John Quincy Adams would have loved to have seen. Society changing right in front of you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And, you know, conservatives don't like that. You know, conservative is a man standing athwart the arc of history with his hand out shouting, stop.
But that's how it works.
It's the good, the bad, and the very, very tootlishly ugly, the good.
The Kentucky House of Representatives. On Tuesday, the Kentucky House of Representatives approved a bipartisan bill to provide licenses for those bluegrass state farms interested in growing hemp. The DEA considers hemp a controlled substance because it is technically a cannabinoid, same species of plant as marijuana. But Kentuckians of both parties see through the DEA's outdated rules. Hemp cultivation would be a boon for the state. It would rake in millions in tax revenue and provide countless farming jobs for its residents. Our hemp laws are unfair and impractical. Way to go, Kansas, for joining in with other states like Maine, Maryland, and Vermont in making rational hemp policy a reality. The bad. Armed Citizen Project. What's the best way to help a struggling community stay safe? Well, if you said single-barrel shotguns, you're right. The Tucson, well, maybe not. The Tucson, Arizona chapter of the pro-gun group Armed Citizen Project announced on Tuesday a plan to distribute free shotguns to three Tucson neighborhoods that have seen a rapid increase in crime over the past few months. According to Armed Citizen member Sean McCluskey, the initiative will reduce violence and keep citizens safe while the city struggles to fund its law enforcement agencies. In reality, there is zero proof that gun ownership makes communities safer. Arming Tucson residents stir up paranoia and fear, increasing the likelihood of accidental gun deaths, or even worse, another massacre. And the very, very ugly, David Vitter. Remember Obama phones? Those awesome free smartphones that the White House helped distribute to greedy poor people? If you said no, then like most of us, you realize that the whole Obama phone scare was just a racist myth used by Republicans to ramp up the fear meter at the height of the 2012 election cycle. Apparently, Louisiana Senator David Vitter didn't get the message. Earlier this week, he proposed an amendment to the Senate's budget that would have defunded the Lifeline program. Now, Lifeline dates back to the Reagan era, and it helps low-income Americans pay for phone service, not actual phones. Luckily, the Senate voted down Vitter's proposal, but the fact that Vitter is still worked up about Obama phones, even after most of his Republican colleagues had let the whole bigoted lie drop, is very, very. It's actually a program that was started by Ronald Reagan. You know, it's like incredible. Gary in Lithonia, Georgia. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Love your program.
Thanks. What's on your mind?
On the issue of judicial review by the Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
I think it's just an unintended consequence that they get the review laws passed by Congress. Now, my understanding is the only thing they can't review is the Constitution. If the Constitution is amended, I don't think they're capable of overseeing that review.
Well, if the Constitution's explicit about something, I mean, under the doctrine of judicial review, which I disagree, but nonetheless, it is functionally, you know, de facto, it's been the law of the land since 1803. This notion of judicial review, the Supreme Court can determine what the meaning of the Constitution is and then strike down a law if they decide that that law conflicts with the meaning of the Constitution. And their striking down of that law is binding upon the executive branch and the legislative branch. And that last part of it, you know, I would agree with Thomas Jefferson that the Supreme Court can say, we think this law is not constitutional. But that doesn't mean that the president has to agree with them and do what they say. And that doesn't mean that the legislature has to agree with them and do what they say. You know, in my opinion.
The intent of the founders were to have, I guess, 9 wise, unbiased, rational men that all matters can at last resort go to for them to make a judgment, a sound judgment.
Well, it wasn't so much, gee, let's have some wise people. It was more like there's got to be an end of the road to litigation. There's got to be a point at which if my dog ate your chicken and I'm arguing, hey, you shouldn't let your chicken wander into my yard, and you're arguing, hey, you shouldn't have had a chicken-eating dog on your property, and we're fighting back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and I get a judge to agree with me, and then you get a judge to agree with you, and then, you know, back, and eventually some court somewhere has to say, no, it's the fault of the dog or the fault of the chicken or the owner thereof. And, I mean, literally, a number of dog-chicken cases were brought before the Supreme Court in the first 50 years of this country. And that's what it has to, and that's, you know, the Court of Final Appeals. But that doesn't mean that the Supreme Court can say, well, you know, the Constitution says that dogs can eat chickens, and therefore we're going to strike down the law that says that dogs have to be, you know, docile or whatever.
Well, I think as it pertains to the Constitution, and I think that's why they gave them the term, the appointment for life.
No, they gave them the appointment for life so they would not be responsive to moneyed interests. I mean, read the debates when the Constitution was being put together. The thing that everybody was paranoid about was rich people. And you know, about two-thirds of the people in the Constitutional Convention were not wealthy by the standards of the day. And the third who were wealthy, none of them owned wealth. I mean, John Hancock was the richest guy. And his net worth was, in today's dollars, about $750,000. He was not a rich guy by today's standards. There were no Bill Gateses in the room. There were no Warren Buffetts in the room. No David Kochs in the room.
Now, here's where you and I disagree. You are a very decent person, and you think all people are decent. But if I put you that...
I don't think all people are decent.
Well, you like to believe all people are decent.
I would hope that all people are decent, but I acknowledge that there are some people who are warped by virtue of birth or experience. I don't know, and they end up being irredeemable, evil, and should be, you know, locked away from society for the rest of their lives. It'd be crazy not to acknowledge that Charles Manson is real.
But what I'm trying to say, you give the person the benefit of the doubt. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Well, that's the whole point of our legal system, is that until a jury, your peers, has said you're guilty, you're considered innocent.
Well, as a minority, I need a court to have the powers that they have now, because you see, Tom, you have no skin in the game. You are a white male Christian American. You're at the top of the food chain for gays, blacks, women. We're at the whims of at majority.
Gary, I agree with you. I'm the first to acknowledge that I refer to it as the lucky sperm club, that I'm very fortunate to be born white in this society, I mean, white and middle class, you know, that my dad worked in a tool and die shop. But therefore, I don't get the therefore out of that.
No, I'm saying as a minority, I need a court. Be the court of last resort.
Right.
You know, it's bad.
Everybody does.
We have four, which I think are biased, racist persons sitting there now. But you know what? I still want them to be in that position. Hopefully, we can change them in an election.
Okay. So you're basically the flag that you're posting on the hill that you're claiming here with this flag, Gary, is that you're in support of judicial review. You think that we should be a constitutional monarchy, that there should be a group of 9 people who play the role of king and say, or queen, and say, this is what the Constitution means.
Yes. Well, if
and I respectfully disagree with you. I think that The people themselves should be the ones who decide what the Constitution means, and they should exercise that decision through the ballot box by electing elected officials.
That's why I'm saying the people, the majority can't be trusted, Tom. That's what I'm saying. In right. South Carolina, I would put to you that if they have a vote now to put back slavery in effect, you'll be surprised at the majority, a percentage of those who agree.
I don't disagree with you, Gary, and if that were to happen, you would be amazed at the blowback. And, you know, that balancing act, that back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, is what eventually gets you to people waking up and then there being system-wide social changes. In fact, I would say that's what's happening with gay rights right now.
But in the meantime, Tom, how many gay kids need to commit suicide and die while we wait for society to have a change of heart? How many slaves were supposed to be killed or mutilated while the society changed and realized that they were wrong?
But see, the Supreme Court was not the solution to that. The Supreme Court in 1856 did not rule that there should be no slavery, even though the founders wrote it into the Constitution that the institution would begin to unravel in 1808. And you can read it in the Constitution that there would be no importation of slaves after that. In 1856, instead, the Supreme Court ruled that African Americans were, period, property. End of, full stop, end of discussion. When Roger Taney is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, he thought he was going to end the debate for all time and bring peace to America. And what did he do? The Taney Court caused the Civil War.
But that's what I'm saying. This is the law of unintended consequences.
Well, I'm saying that's the consequence of judicial review. That was the one time after 1803 in Marbury versus Madison that the court had tried to rule based on constitutionality. That he was saying, Taney was saying basically that he found slavery in the Constitution. And I think you could argue that slavery was in the Constitution, although you could also argue that slavery was supposed to dissolve out of it.
Each man is created equal, so there's a conflict.
But see, each man is not created equal if you have a Supreme Court that has the final say over the law of the land. And they're appointed for life. You have nine unelected kings or queens. That's not equal. Gary, thank you for the call. I respectfully disagree. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's interesting to go through the logic in some of these arguments and then wander off on a little discursion and then come back. Okay. Now, I don't think the Supreme Court should have this. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you. Now, by the way, let me just be very clear. When I say I don't think that the Supreme Court should have the power to strike down laws, I'm saying that in a totally generic sense. I very much want the Supreme Court to strike down DOMA because, frankly, this president is not doing what he should be doing, which is refusing to enforce it. It should be in this... I mean, this is a debate that goes back to the founding of the Republic, but the founders of this Republic were quite clear about it, that every branch, each of the three branches of government, if they believe that something is unconstitutional, they have not only the right, but the obligation to act on that belief. So if Congress passes a law that says that the IRS cannot recognize gay marriages in the state of California or the Washington state where it's legal, then the president, if he believes that to be unconstitutional, and I believe he has made that assertion, although I can't say that with certainty. Shana, you're nodding your head, so he has asserted that. Okay. If the president believes that it's unconstitutional, then he should stop enforcing it. And then, if you want to put it before the Supreme Court, somebody who can demonstrate a harm as a consequence of it not being enforced, which is going to be hard to find, I think, we can come forward and say, we want this law enforced. But this is that whole issue of standing. Simon in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Simon, thanks for listening to KTNF. What's up?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted, I know how much you like phraseology, and I'm the child of a same-sex couple. They've been together for longer than the internet has been around.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that it's not about granting a right when it comes to marriage. It's about recognizing a freedom that has always existed, a freedom to marry.
Yes.
I think it's really important to think that sort of way.
That's great.
Of phrase it in that sense, because I think it's much more identifiable that way.
Yeah. Simon, I think you are absolutely right, and thank you for establishing the frame that we are talking about the freedom to marry. And freedom is a word that, you know, conservatives love. The freedom to marry, I would say, as well as the right to marry. But we should certainly be talking about freedom. Thank you, Simon, for the call. Thanks for listening to Minnesota's Progressive Talk. Jay in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Jay.
Hi there. Longtime listener. Back to women as property.
Yeah.
I have a little family story to share. And now, I'm 70 years old, so we can put this on a timeline. But my late mother-in-law was widowed young in West Texas. And in order to manage the property that would have been hers, she had to go to court, and the phrase then was she went to court and was declared a femme sole, which meant that she had the standing in court of a man.
Wow.
For legal purposes, she was male.
Right. So she had to argue before a court that she should have the rights of a man. And they had a provision to provide that, but it was not the norm.
Probably a pretty common process, the way they talked about
it. So this would have been, the 19-teens, the 1920s?
Okay, well, let's see. Her son is now in his 80s, and he was already born. So
this was after women got the right to vote.
But this was in West Texas, and apparently it was a fairly common practice.
Very interesting.
When a woman inherited property and she didn't have a father or a brother to take it for her,
she had to be declared male.
She could go to court and be declared a femme sole.
Amazing. Jay, thank you for sharing that with us. I want to. We're right up to the end of the show here. I want to get a couple more calls in, but thank you so much for the call, and thanks for sharing that with us. Roman in Lanesburg, Michigan. Hey, Roman, what's up?
Hi, how's it going? I was just wondering, I haven't read your book, Unequal Protection, yet, but I was wondering about the story of Dartmouth, the Woodward
1815?
And specifically how the president of the university was disposed of.
I don't remember the details of the case. I'm sorry. I can't speak to it. My recollection of Dartmouth is that was the first case in which a corporation pled before the Supreme Court and was granted standing. And thus,
I don't know if it was a corporation. It was a legal entity.
Right. Definitely. But it wasn't a corporation in the modern sense of a corporation. Those didn't really come into being in stock corporations until after the Civil War. But at that point in time, it was a corporate entity. It was actually Dartmouth was foreign owned corporate entity. It was British owned, as I recall. And so there was this process of establishing some sort of standing before the court. But I'm not in any way an expert on the Woodward case, the Dartmouth versus Woodward case. I'm sorry, Roman. I can tell you all about Santa Clara County. I can virtually recite the pleadings in Santa Clara County, but Woodward, no. Jeff in Portland. Hey, Jeff, we got a minute to the break. You want to talk about Canada?
Oh, yeah, Tom. I just got back from a short trip up there last week. They were working on their own budget deal. I wanted to try and bring up two quick huge differences between their discussion on their budget compared to ours. And the first one is the national health care they have. That's not even part of their negotiations. Even the conservatives up there do not question their national health care.
Of course.
And the reason is not only is it the ultimate moral and patriotic expression of taking care of our own philosophy, but it also is a fiscally responsible way to run a country.
Yep. And, they pay half of what we do for healthcare. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Dean Baker's written a lot about that. And we pay, as a percentage of our GDP, 50% more than they do for healthcare.
Yep. Yep.
And all the other countries like France, who's way ahead of us as far as healthcare.
I'm with you. Jeff, you're going to have to call back another time with your second point. I'm sorry we're out of time, but I appreciate your calling and thank you for listening.
Coming up tomorrow, we'll have the latest on DOMA, the sequester, the debt ceiling deal, the new hostage taking that the GOP doesn't want you to know about. Plus, we'll have a conversation with attorney Mike Papantonio of Ring of Fire Radio. Plus, my favorite segment of the week, Geeky Science, along with the best of the rest of the news and your calls. We have the Tom Hartman program. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you. Show up. Go to free-don.org. Tag, you're it. See you.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.